We believe that alcoholism is a disease and that Alcoholics Anonymous is one solution to that disease. I'm here to bring you the voices of its members. Everyone that comes on the show, including myself, is an active member and has found recovery in the rooms of AA. As you listen, please take what works for you and leave the rest.
My name is Heather, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is June 1st, 2016. My home group is in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, which is right outside of Philadelphia. It's a women's group. And I have a sponsor who has over 30 years of sobriety. I still talk to her once a week. We do a reading in our big book, a couple pages, and we do a discussion every Tuesday. So I don't think that's required between sponsors and sponsees, but I am grateful that I do have that with that connection with her still. So I'll share my experience, strength, and hope. My experience starts with a good upbringing. I was raised in a good family. I have two parents that were not alcoholics. I was raised Catholic. I always went to church. I was a big believer in God when I was a little girl. I prayed a lot. I would write JMJ on my pillow before I went to bed every night. I always tried to recite my prayers before I went to bed every night. And I just always tried to follow what the Catholic Church had taught me about being good. And if you're good, you go to heaven. So I didn't have any trauma as a child. I, like I said, I had a very good upbringing. I was raised in a loving home. I will say, if I look back at my younger self, I was always very anxious. I was very timid. I think I was always kind of nervous. I did have friends. I had a lot of friends growing up. I was active in sports, but I think I always just felt like I was mediocre in everything. You know, I was average in sports. I was average in my school studies. I mean, I think we all compared ourselves to our classmates and friends and wanting to be better and wishing that we were smarter, you know, wishing we were more athletic, prettier, always trying to fit in a little bit more, never really happy with yourself. So I think some of that's normal as a kid growing up, but I don't know. I just felt like I was always anxious. So I think looking back at that, that was part of my disease. So then go forward to high school. I think I had my first drink when I was a junior in high school, maybe. And I don't know why I remember this, but it was a fuzzy navel, and that's such a weird drink. I think it's peach schnapps and orange juice. And I think I had that. My parents, I think, were away, and I think my brothers had friends over, and one of them, someone made me one of those drinks. And so that was my first drink, and that, I don't know why that always stuck with me. I think probably because I liked the way it felt. So yeah, it was a fuzzy navel. And then I kind of just drank here and there at junior, senior high school, and not any more than my other friends were, a couple beers here and there. And I do remember liking the effect that alcohol gave me, but I don't remember it being like this powerful effect. I just remember liking it. But the first thing that I think of when I really look at my drinking that sticks out is when I went to Cancun at my senior year of high school. Right after we graduated, I went with a bunch of my girlfriends. So that was our first big trip away without parents. And we were pretty responsible for 17, 18 year olds. And I remember we had access to alcohol in Cancun that you wouldn't here in the States. And I remember I was the only one out of my group of friends that didn't get sick, and we were all drinking a lot. And I was the only one that could really drink that week. And I was almost proud of that. I didn't get sick. And I think that's when I discovered I had this high tolerance for alcohol. And I remember being proud of that. Like, I thought that was a good thing. So I graduated high school, and I didn't go away to college, which, looking back, that's probably a blessing, because I think I probably would have failed out if I had that freedom to go away to college and really drink. So I stayed home and I worked, and I went to community college, and then later went to college for physical therapy in Philadelphia. So I commuted. So I was able to work. I stayed home. I studied, and I would drink Thursday, Friday, Saturdays, some Sundays. But I still worked hard and focused on my studies. And then, you know, I turned 21 and I start going to bars. And this is where that high tolerance starts to hit me again, where I'm drinking beer, I'm doing shots. And I remember I would count how many beers I could have and how many shots I could do. And the next morning I was like, oh, I had 6 beers and 3 shots. And I'd be proud of that. I had this high tolerance and I thought this was like a gift. So that allergy that they talk about in the doctor's opinion, that adverse reaction to alcohol, that's what I was having. But I was looking at that as like, oh, I have this special superpower, high tolerance to alcohol. The girl over there can only have 2 drinks and she gets all like dizzy and can't have any more. Well, she was having a normal reaction to alcohol. Back then, I didn't know that. I thought this was like, this is what I'm good at. Finally, I'm good at something. And it was drinking. And so I thought, this is great. I can hang with these guys and I can drink all these beers. I didn't black out. I rarely got sick. I never threw up. I was very high functioning, still working, still, you know, studying. And I graduated, got my first job in physical therapy. And so then I'm working Monday to Friday. Try to just keep it Thursday, Friday, Saturday, some Sundays drinking. And then it slowly started to creep in on Mondays. Like I'd work a full day and I'd say, well, I worked all day. I can go home and have a couple beers. And so then the drinking started to slowly progress. I eventually met my now ex-husband. We had a alcohol-based relationship where we connected and had a good time in the beginning. All we knew how to do was drink together, but we had a lot of fun. And so I get married. We have 2 kids. We still like to drink and we're still working and get through our daily life. But as life happens and things get harder, I start to notice he's not doing much other than going to work and then coming home and drinking. And I'm kind of falling into that same pattern. And I kept thinking to myself, like, is this how life is supposed to be? Like deep down inside of me, I kept thinking, like, this doesn't seem right. But I married him. So I just kept trying to do my best as a mom, raising my 2 little kids, going to work. But when it came to the marriage aspect of it, me and him had poor communication skills. We get in a fight and we wouldn't discuss it. Instead, we'd do a shot and drink and try to forget about it. And this went on for a few years. And then there was a lot of financial abuse, verbal abuse, mental abuse. And then I was starting to drink to block out stuff, to cope. But it went to a point where I hit a breaking point and I knew that this isn't where I was supposed to be in my life. And even though I had stopped praying years ago when I had started drinking, I think the more I drank all those years, the younger me stopped praying. I don't know when I stopped, but it was during that time where I think once alcohol took over, I started to step further away from God. And then not that I didn't believe in God. I think I just kind of had him blocked out. Like God was blocked out of my life. But I think for some reason, I truly believe that God still gave me the strength to get up and get out of that house and out of that relationship. Something told me that this was not the life that I was supposed to be living, even though I was still drinking as well. So I did. I took the 2 kids and I left. We were married just under 7 years and I got up and I took the 2 kids and I moved back in with my parents. And at first that was a good thing and I was relieved and I was in a more peaceful home. And I felt relief because I had gotten myself out of that situation. So I went from drinking to block all that out to now I'm depressed. I'm sad. So now I'm drinking to cope and to grieve because I'm grieving my marriage, the loss of the marriage. I had a 3- and 5-year-old at the time. And now I'm living back with my parents. So when I moved in with my parents, I was back in my old bedroom from when I was a teenager, but now the bedroom is dark gray. It's got dark gray carpets and it's got black curtains. And when I told my sponsor about this, she said that that bedroom acted like a mold for my disease, because my my disease just fed on that. It just grew because it was dark. And I used to go into that bedroom, close the curtains, and I would keep a handle of Southern Comfort in one of my drawers, my pajama pants drawer. I always remember that. It was the second drawer down. I would just drink and cry and pass out every night. And I did that for years. I ended up living there for, I think it ended up being 4 years. But the last year, so this was 2012, and in 2015, I'm still in this, you know, in this dark place. I'm still living at my parents'. I feel like a failure. I feel like my marriage had failed. I was a failure. I was a single mom living back with my parents. I no longer had a home. I no longer had a husband, and I had no idea where my life was headed. And so I found comfort in that bottle of Southern Comfort, and I was drinking a lot of it. So 2015, I don't know what happened, but I like hit the self-destruct button on my disease. So it was like a slow progression, drinking to party in my early 20s. And then I was drinking throughout my marriage, and then drinking to cope, drinking to block. And now I was just in full blown depression, and I like hit the acceleration button. 2015, I like skyrocketed down with my drinking. I was drinking almost 24/7. I was drinking as soon as I woke up in the morning. I was drinking to get through my day because I would start to shake. I was basically drinking to function. I wasn't even drinking to get drunk at that point. I literally couldn't function without it. And I hadn't skipped a day of drinking. I was drinking every day for years. There wasn't a day that I wasn't drinking. Now, in the beginning, I wasn't drinking 24/7. I was still drinking daily, but I could at least get through the workday. At this point, I wasn't even able to get through the workday. I had to sneak in little airplane bottles into my job and go into the bathroom and drink them just so I wouldn't shake when I was working on patients. I mean, I could have lost my job, but I was afraid I'd lose my job if I went through withdrawal out on the floor. So it's like this vicious cycle I was living in 2015. Now, in the same year, for some reason, God places a man in my life when I'm at my absolute worst. But because I hid my alcoholism so well, he saw me as a good mom, looks like she's trying to get her life back in order. And he would want me to go out for a cup of coffee, and I'm trying to turn him into a new drinking buddy, right? So I'd be like, no, I'd rather go to the bar and have a couple beers. And I think in the beginning, he was okay with that. But then I don't think he realized how sick I was. And so that year I was trying to date this guy as I'm spiraling down into my disease. Fast forward to August 2015. I went on a vacation with my family, my parents, my children, my siblings, their spouses, their kids, so my nephews. And I, you know, had my Southern Comfort packed in my suitcase, because I always had a stash with me. I'll point out too, by this point, I'm drinking probably 3 handles of Southern Comfort per week, 3 to 4 easily. That's 59.2 fluid ounces of Southern Comfort. That's a lot of alcohol. In the Outer Banks with my family on this vacation, August 2015, and they catch on to how bad my drinking is. Well, I mean, they started to catch on how bad it was. So the night before the vacation was about to end, and again, a lot of this is foggy that whole week. But I remember they found all my booze I had hidden in my room in the house we were staying in, and they had hidden all the alcohol from me, and we were leaving the next morning. And so it was probably maybe less than 8 hours. With me not having alcohol in my body, and we go to leave, and I'm riding in the passenger seat in my mom's car, and I could feel that I'm probably gonna, I don't even know. I was shaking, and I probably would have went into a seizure. So I can't walk. I go to get out of the car, and I can't walk, and I'm shaking, and my mom's like, what do I do? And I said, I need a beer, mom. I need a beer, because I knew if I put alcohol in my body, then this feeling would go away. Well, my sister wasn't far behind and she's a nurse, and my mom called her and she said, take her to the ER right now. So I think we were in the Chesapeake by then, because we're on our way home from the Outer Banks back to the Philadelphia area. And they took me to a hospital in the Chesapeake. And I don't, again, this is all foggy. I remember being wheeled in. And as much as I don't remember, I do remember this part. It always gets me so upset. I remember seeing my mom in the corner of that, sitting in the corner of that hospital room I was in. And I don't remember what the doctors had said to her or said to me, because it's all blurry, but I vividly remember my mom. Sorry. And the look on her face and how scared she was. And I felt so awful that I had done that and that I had made her feel that way. And she pleaded with the doctor. I think the doctor wanted to keep me there for, I think he probably wanted to make me and get me into a rehab, but we were on our way home and my mom pleaded with him, like, can we please just get her home and then we'll take care of what we need to do once we get her back. And I think she said the doctor wasn't really happy with her about that, but so we were able to leave. I'm pretty sure he had given me, medication to go home with, because obviously I was going to detox. Looking back on that now, I probably should have been admitted and been monitored a little bit closer, but we drove home from the Chesapeake back to the Philadelphia area. And that whole car ride home, I remember I was throwing up, I was shaking, couldn't walk because of the tremors. Finally made it home and I'm back up in that room with the dark curtains and the gray walls. And this is where I detox for the next week. And I will say the detox was awful. It hurt to have blankets on my skin. I slept a lot. I was throwing up. I had DTs to the point where I thought I had a huge spider in my mouth and I spit it out and saw it crawl across my pillow and there was no spider. It ended up just being a pile of my spit. Like I was just hallucinating. That lasted a good week. I think towards the end of that week, I was finally able to make it down the steps, but my legs were still really wobbly. So after a week physically, I started to feel better. And I think initially you feel good because you've been in a fog for so long and your body felt so awful for so long that when you physically start to feel better, you think like, all right, I got this, like I can do this. And it was recommended that I go to intense outpatient rehab, and I was working full time and I had two kids, so I didn't have time for that. So I opted to not do that, and I thought, well, I can do this. Luckily, in that time, I did sign up for a app called SoberGrid that connected me with a lot of people. In fact, I'm still connected with a lot of those people on a daily basis. They're like my lifeline. We're scattered through different states, but we are in a group chat every day, and we stay connected. So I am grateful for that, but that still wasn't enough early on in my sobriety. So I guess I could say I white knuckled and was a dry drunk for about 5 months after that episode in August of 2015. I moved out of my parents' house. I got my own apartment in January 2016. And in February 2016, I had started drinking again. I don't remember what set it off. It was probably something silly, but I remember going to the liquor store and I drank again. This will always stick with me. When I had that first drink after 5 months, even after everything I had been through, all that horrible detox, seeing the look on my mom's face and going through that awful experience, when I took that drink again 5 months later, as soon as that drink went down my throat, I said to myself, oh my God, I love this so much. Why did I ever stop? And that is so scary and powerful, because I know right now, if I were to do the same thing after 7 years of sobriety, I know for a fact that if I were to take a sip right now, I would have that same exact reaction, because that is what the disease does. That's how powerful this disease is. I vividly remember saying those words, like, oh my God, I love this so much. Why did I ever stop? It's like, I totally forgot about all that hell I just put my body through. And that is so scary. So then February to June of 2016, I was bouncing back and forth between staying sober for 30 days at a time to picking up a drink again. And I kept going back and forth and I couldn't understand why. And that man that God had placed in my life was still with me, thank God. And I remember saying to him, I don't know why I keep doing this. I like how I feel when I'm sober. Well, I know now it's because it's a disease of the mind. So I hadn't fixed my mind. I had gotten the alcohol out of my system physically. And I kept doing that, but then I was missing the mental and the spiritual piece. So I finally went to my first meeting in May of 2016. Now, at this first meeting, it was a speaker meeting. It was crowded. It was a Saturday night. They had done a raffle of some sort with it, you know, with tickets, and whoever won the raffle had the ticket. They won a big book. Well, the guy that had won, I guess, already had a big book. And they announced, is there anyone in the audience that needs a big book? And I kid you not, without even thinking about it, something raised my hand, because my hand went up. I didn't even think about it. My hand just went up, which I think is a God moment. And so I walked out of my first AA meeting with a big book, which you normally, I believe you have to purchase. I'm very grateful for that. That is a pretty cool moment for me. So I walked out with the big book, and I had gone to a couple more meetings after that. And I shortly found my sponsor at a Sunday meeting. And the reason why I found my sponsor is because it's a program of attraction, right? I remember whatever she stood up and said that day. And I had had my my pamphlet with all my women's names on it, because it was my first time at that meeting. So I had all the women's names and phone numbers. And she stood up and spoke. And whatever she said attracted me. And I looked at my pamphlet and I matched her name, and her name was on my list. And I called her that night. And that is how I found my sponsor. So I remember I called her that night. And one of the first things she asked me was, well, a couple first things she asked me. One, she asked me if it was just alcohol, which is rare these days, but I am truly just an alcoholic. It was no other drug, no other problem. But I was confused why she had asked me that. But anyway, she asked if it was just alcohol. And I said, yeah, it's strictly just alcohol. And then the other question she asked me was, are you praying? Which I hadn't prayed in a long time. And I was almost uncomfortable that she was asking that. And I said, no, I'm not praying. And she said, well, I'm suggesting to you that you start praying as soon as you wake up in the morning before you go to bed every night. And I was so uncomfortable with that. It's like I had never prayed before, like, because it had been so long. But she suggested it, so that's what I did. Anything that my sponsor suggested, she didn't make me do anything, but anything that she suggested, I did, because I was willing and I was ready. I was just tired. I was tired of stopping and starting and stopping and starting and liking how I felt sober, but then not able to stay sober. So by the time I got to her, I was ready. So anything she suggested, I did. So I did. I got up and I started simple. If I wake up in the morning, I'd say, please, God, help me stay sober today. And then before I would go to bed, I'd say, thank you for guiding me today and for another sober day. And I kept it simple at first. Shortly after that, I started to feel peace. I can't explain it, but that was the start of me feeling peace and not anxious. And it was all because of prayer. It wasn't because I took a drink. It was just like natural peace. Like, I just felt calm for the first time in a long time. And so that was the best thing she could have told me to do. And then, of course, we got right into this step work. So that's when when the strength piece starts. My step work took a year, and it wasn't because we stopped. It was continuous, and it's supposed to be continuous. They say that in the big book. So we didn't stop, but I will tell you that it was done thoroughly, and that's why it took a year. I had to do a lot of reading. I had to do a lot of praying, a lot of reflecting. My sponsor made me do a defect list before my step four work, where I had to look up the definition of all the character defects. It's called the defect list. And I had to write out the definition of each word and write the opposite meaning of each word, what the root cause of it was, how it affected me. And it was a lot of writing and reflecting. That was before I even started my step four. And so, like I said, it took me a good year, but it was done very thoroughly. And I'm very, very thankful for that. I also got a home group in that time frame. I started doing service work. I would bring donuts to my Sunday meeting. I was the treasurer for my women's group meeting. I would speak when I was asked, even though it's sometimes uncomfortable. So I got really involved in going to meetings. My first year, I also went to Akron. I went to visit Dr. Bob's house, Founders Day. I did that 2 years so far. But yeah, my first year, in fact, I got my first year coin at the St. Thomas Hospital meditation meeting, which is pretty cool. So yeah, I really just, I dove into the program. I stayed close to my sponsor. And yeah, it just, everything from that point on got better. And so then that's where the hope piece comes in. Since I got sober, I have since bought a house. I have since got a dog for my kids. I have a really good relationship with my kids. They get to see what a sober mom looks like. I'm very open and honest with them about my disease. They come to me about their problems. We have a nice, loving home. I recently just got married 2 years ago to that same guy that stuck with me at my worst. We have a really good relationship. It's healthy. We communicate. We are open and honest about our finances, about how we raise the kids. We both work hard in life and in our home. I took on a second job in my sobriety, which I would not have been able to do if I was still drinking. I do home health as well as outpatient care. I have to drive around and see patients. I would not have done that if I was still drinking. I wouldn't have been able to. It would have just cut into my drinking, so it wouldn't have been convenient. So I'm able to carry two jobs now. Yeah, and I stay connected with my sponsor. Like I said earlier, we still talk once a week. I have a group of friends that I still connect with every day, and I'm very grateful for that. My life has changed according to the AA principles. I no longer have the obsession to drink, which is a miracle. I used to think about drinking every day. I'm still in awe of that. Some days will pass by, I'm like, oh, I think about a drink, and I think that's amazing. And some days it does happen, but the difference is, my sponsor calls it this, she'll say, that's a pop-up. Like summertime, you'll think like, oh, a cold beer would be good right now. And it comes and goes. That's a pop-up. If it lingers and I start to obsess about it, that's where the problem is. But I'm aware of that. There's a difference. I've also unblocked God. Like I said, I never stopped believing in God. I was blocked. And so now I can see life clearer and differently. And now I pray when I start to worry or if fears pop up, I know to turn to God. And I see life differently. You know, my kids, they kind of laugh that they all know that I make a big deal out of seeing butterflies. Well, when I first got sober, when I first started doing my steps with my sponsor, I started to see butterflies pop up everywhere. And they would just appear at like random times, like if I was praying or if I was having a hard time, I'd see one. And I always say like, it's not that they weren't there before. I just hadn't seen them in years because I was living in such a fog for so long. So then all of a sudden I'm seeing butterflies, and that's just part of the spiritual awakening. Same with sunrises and sunsets. On vacations, not now, I'm not hungover, and I set my alarm and me and my daughter get up and we go watch the sunrise. I never would have been able to do that before. And I missed so many because I was drinking on vacations, and I'm so grateful for that. I take pictures of everything now. I actually got a camera and I'll take pictures of the sunsets and the butterflies. And I'm just so fully present in my life. And that's part of the promises. I count my blessings instead of wishing I had more. I appreciate the little things in life. And I'm very grateful at the end of each day. Life still gets hard and some days aren't easy and some days are easier than others, but I don't need to drink over it anymore. And I can always work through it. And things always turn out to be okay. And like my sponsor also always says, all is well. And it is. I'm aware that I still need to work on some things, and I realize that this is a lifetime process of growth, but I'm very grateful that I have this way of living now. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Heather. So at the end there, I guess I'll start there. You had said, I'm aware that I need to work on some things. Is there something in particular that you found struggling with at 7 years?
No, I think it's just the character defects that we have that tend to pop up in everyday life. They're going to continually pop up, and we have to be aware of that.
All right. Okay, so we will move on then, if there's nothing meaty and good there. But I do like that last quote, too. I count my blessings instead of wishing I want more or wishing I had more. I really like that. Okay, so what is JMJ?
Jesus, Mary, and Joseph.
Oh, okay. Okay, okay. I grew up Catholic. I'm a little bit embarrassed I didn't know that, but okay.
I think that might have been taught by my grandmom. I think that's where I picked that up.
It's very cute. Before you got sober through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you got onto it's called Sober Grid.
Yep.
And on there, I imagine it's not Alcoholics Anonymous related. It's just sober related.
It's right. So there's a mixture. If I remember correctly, I think there was a mixture of addictions, but a lot of it was alcohol because that's where I found my core group and we're all in the program now. It kind of acted like a stepping stone for me. Because there were people on there that were talking about AA and meetings and the big book and stuff like that. So that kind of introduced me to the program.
Did you have an opinion of the program at that point?
I didn't. I didn't know anything about it. Oh, I forgot a big piece of my story.
Let's hear it.
So in that time frame where I was a dry drunk, my parents had connected me with a priest in our parish who was in the program, which is interesting. And so he met me in the rectory. And so he's another big piece of my sobriety. And I hate that I forgot to put that in there. And why I loved that part of it is because he was a Catholic priest and the Catholic upbringing had warped me a little bit with God. It helped me believe in God. So I had no problem with step two of the program, but the Catholic Church kind of made me fear God, right? So I got to meet him. He's in the program. I'm in the rectory. He's in regular clothes. And he just kind of talked to me like one alcoholic to another, but at the same time, making me feel better as a person and as a Catholic, because it was almost like I did a confession with him, kind of. And that gave me peace, I feel like. That helped. And then he kind of introduced me to the program as well. And he actually offered to go to a meeting with him, which was very cool. And he gave me his phone number and I could text him if I needed to. So I'm very grateful for him. He's still in the program. I think he's changed parishes since. I believe that God placed him in my life for that reason as well. And that's a big part of my story too.
Along with the priest, how did you find your first meeting?
So my one friend who I met on the Sober Grid app, she lived in this area and she had asked me to meet her for coffee, and we met for coffee and kind of shared our sobriety stories, and agreed that we would go to our first meeting together. And so that's how that happened. And I don't remember if I looked one up or if she looked one up. But that we went to that first meeting together that night I got the big book.
I don't think anybody should have to pay for a big book. If they're at a meeting and they don't have one, they should walk away with one no matter what.
Yeah.
But
I agree.
To your comment there, I recorded a gentleman, the episode right before you, and he had said, I think Bill W. would have embraced all of the technology today to reach more people as much as possible. And I agree. Sober Grid is an example of, it may not be AA stamped approved, but it is another path to recovery. And probably a lot of the times the rooms of AA.
Absolutely. If I hadn't found Sober Grid, so when I went to Akron, it's with that group of people I met on Sober Grid. Mm. You know, like we are in touch every day still. And this was from 2015. It's now 2023. I met these people and I've met them in person several times since then. And we're strongly connected. I think that's amazing.
That is amazing. What was the best part of you gone to Founders Day twice, you said?
Yeah. The first year was emotional for me because it was June of 2017. So I was 1 year sober and, you know, so I'm already like so excited. It's my first year of sobriety, but that whole first year I'm reading the big book with my sponsor, right? So the Mayflower, like everything I read in the book that whole year, I got to experience. And so it was very emotional. All of it was very emotional. I cried a lot, like happy tears, gratitude tears, like thank God for these men and for this program, because, you know, alcoholics were hospitalized or thrown in like loony bins and they didn't know what to do with them. And thank God, you know, that's how I was. So it's like, thank God they have a program and thank God I found my way out of it, you know, out of this addiction and because of these two men and how it all came together. It was really cool to be there and experience all that. I was very emotional that year.
All of our emotions are so raw in the beginning.
Yeah. Just even reliving like how sick I was, you know, you couldn't get upset when I was talking about my mom in that hospital room. It's like, it was so long ago, but you still remember it and you feel it.
Is your mom still here?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
How is that relationship?
Great. Yeah. I love that she got to see me completely change my life, you know, because I lived with her when I was sick and, you know, I hid that from my parents. They had no idea how bad I was. I was very high functioning, but they had no idea I had all that alcohol hidden in that room. So I think they felt guilty when that happened that week down in the Outer Banks, because it was like, how did they not see it? Like, how did they let it get that bad? Because I was living under their roof almost. So I think that's why she had that look on her face. But now I love that I can be an example to other family members and my mom gets to see how sobriety has changed my life completely. I mean, I completely changed my life.
Yeah. What a good example you are for your nieces and nephews and children.
Yeah, now I am. Luckily my kids were 5 and 7 when I got sober, so I'm hoping they don't remember. I'm open with them about it now, but I don't think they really remember or understand how sick I was. I am very honest about it.
Yeah.
My daughter is 16, she'll be 17 now. So I try to be open and honest about, you know, how scary the disease can be.
So scary.
And I could have died.
Yeah. So many times. That's just the time that, so you didn't sound like you were a blackout drinker.
I wasn't. I would be foggy. Like I would have to be like refreshed on what we did the night before in some time. Like, you know, remember we said this, oh yeah. And I'll laugh, but I never had like true blackouts where people were like, don't even remember the night. Like that's scary.
Oh yeah.
Thankfully I wasn't a blackout.
Yeah.
Never had DUIs or anything like that. But I mean, physically I was very sick. I was very sick. I forgot to mention how sick I was as far as like vomiting in the morning and then washing it down with more booze just to get through the day. I mean, that's sick.
Yeah. Well, I love how you started your share. It was quite humble. Anybody that was paying as closely attention as I was, you had said that you kind of went through the list of things that you do and then you followed it up with, you don't think that is necessarily required for everyone to do. That's just what you do, which it sounds like you do call your sponsor once a week, get in the book. You're kind of doing everything you did that you did back in 2016.
Yep. Yeah. And I don't know if other sponsors and sponsees do that. It's just what we always did a weekly phone call, but then we changed it up and started reading the big book again. Like I said, it's just 2 pages. We have a week to read it. And then we discuss it every Tuesday morning. And I love it because, and I'm sure you've found this, it changes as you grow and change to the program. Like you get different messages out of that book as you change and grow. You see different things in the book that you didn't see before. And even her, over 30 years sober, she'll pick stuff out. And I think it's important to keep our hand in that book.
it is really magical, the words on the page and the meaning and how it shifts every time I read it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of magic in that book.
Definitely.
Is there anything that you're thinking of now or anything that you left out of your story that you'd like to share?
Probably. I'll probably hang up and remember something that I should have said. I feel like every time I share my story, I always forget something. But I think I got most of it.
Okay.
I always say, like, my sponsor always says the hope piece of my story is her favorite part. And that should be the biggest part of my share. But for me, when I came into the program, what hooked me into a speaker was the experience, because I needed to hear that that girl drank like I did.
Or, mm-hmm.
you know, I wanted to hear, like, how much did they drink? DUIs or not, I was drinking 3 handles of Southern Comfort a week. I needed to hear that someone drank like me, and that would hook me in. But my sponsor's always like, it's the hope piece. And she's right. She's right. But I think it depends on where you're at in the program. Like I said, early on, I wanted to hear your experience. I always like to get into how sick I was, because how powerful alcohol was and how sick I got on it.
I thought when people said somebody's qualifying, I thought that mm-hmm. was just the experience start of a share, where
yeah.
you're qualifying that you were as messed up as I was and I should listen to anything else you're saying.
Oh, yeah.
And
that's a good way of putting it.
I drank and then got sober and then drank and then get a month. And then, I mean, I was just, so for me, the hope part of people's stories, I could not relate to. That was good mm-hmm. for you, but happiness and peace and joy and serenity, that'll never, ever, ever, ever be a part of my life. So I don't really need to hear about how happy you are. I want right. to hear about how bad it was. Do you know what it's like to be me? And then, how did you get sober? That's all I wanted, was the first and second part. As soon as See? They'd go on and on about their hope, it literally Lost was you. Like not applicable. And my brain yep. would just like not listen.
Yeah.
Because it was so far from my experience that
That's
I had
That's not had. Where you were at. Yeah.
So there's definitely balance. I think there's balance. Yeah. I think for me, the most important thing is the newcomer. If you've had some time, you can get your hope anywhere you want. I'm focused on the right. newcomer.
Right.
I like the piece of the story where we came into the rooms, and I'm so mm-hmm. glad that you got to share about the priest that was in the program.
Yeah. Thank you for that. I forgot to. Yeah.
Well, you brought it up, so it yeah. worked out well. All right. Final question for the alcoholic out there still suffering, that newcomer. What message would you like to leave for them?
Find a good sponsor. I think that's really important. And like I said, do what's suggested and you'll be okay. And pray. That was probably the best thing I did in the beginning. Before I even dived into this step work, you have to start praying to some sort of higher power or something, because I really think that's what helped me start seeing the butterflies.
Cute. That's very cute. Well said. All right. Thank you so much, Heather.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
For more information, read the first 164 pages of The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous or visit keepcomingback.net.